"Are you all right?" said Two Flower. Rincewind opened his eyes. The wizard sat up hurriedly and grabbed Two Flower by the shirt. "I want to leave here," he said urgently, "right now."
"But there's going to be an ancient and traditional ceremony."
"I don't care how ancient. I want the feel of honest cobbles under my feet. I want the old familiar smell of cesspits. I want to go where there's lots of people and fires and roofs and walls and friendly things like that. I want to go home." He found that he had this sudden, desperate longing for the fuming, smoky streets of Ankh Morpork, which was always at its best in the spring, when the gummy sheen on the turbid waters of the Ankh River had a special iridescence, and the eaves were full of birdsong, or at least birds coughing rhythmically. A tear sprang to his eyes as he recalled the subtle play of light on the Temple of Small Gods, a noted local landmark, and a lump came to his throat when he remembered the fried fish stall on the junction of Midden Street and the Street of Cunning Artificers. He thought of the gherkins they sold there, great green things lurking at the bottom of their jar like drowned whales. They called to Rincewind across the miles, promising to introduce him to the pickled eggs in the next jar. He thought of the cosy livery stable lofts and warm gratings where he spent his nights. Foolishly, he had sometimes jibed at this way of life. It seemed incredible now, but he had found it boring. Now he had had enough. He was going home. "Pickled gherkins, I hear you calling." He pushed Two Flower aside, gathered his tattered robe around him with great dignity, set his face towards that area of horizon he believed to contain the city of his birth, and with intense determination and considerable absent-mindedness, stepped right off the top of a 30-foot trilithon. Some 10 minutes later, when a worried and rather contrite Two Flower dug him out of the large snowdrift at the base of the stones, his expression hadn't changed. Two Flower peered at him. "Are you all right?" he said. "How many fingers am I holding up?"
"I want to go home."
"Okay."
"No, don't try and talk me out of it. I've had enough. I'd like to say it's been great fun, but I can't, and..."
"What?" "I said okay," said Two Flower. "I'd quite like to see Ankh Morpork again. I expect they've rebuilt quite a lot of it by now."
It should be noted that the last time the two of them had seen the city, it was burning quite fiercely, a fact which had a lot to do with Two Flower introducing the concept of fire insurance to a venial but ignorant populace. But devastating fires were a regular feature of Morporkian life, and it had always been cheerfully and meticulously rebuilt, using the traditional local materials of tinder-dry wood and thatch waterproofed with tar.
"Oh," said Rincewind, deflating a bit. "Oh, right. Oh, right then, good. Perhaps we'd better be off then."
He scrambled up and brushed the snow off himself. "Only I think we should wait until morning," added Two Flower.
"Why?"
"Well, because it's freezing cold. We don't really know where we are. The luggage has gone missing. It's getting dark."
Rincewind paused. In the deep canyons of his mind, he thought he heard the distant rustle of ancient paper. He had a horrible feeling that his dreams were going to be very repetitive from now on, and he had much better things to do than be lectured by a bunch of ancient spells who couldn't even agree on how the universe began. A tiny, dry voice at the back of his brain said,
"What things?"
"Oh, shut up," he said. "I only said it's freezing cold, and..." Two Flower began.
"I didn't mean you. I meant me."
"What?"
"Oh, shut up," said Rincewind wearily. "I don't suppose there's anything to eat around here."
The giant stones were black and menacing against the dying green light of sunset. The inner circle was full of druids, scurrying around by the light of several bonfires and tuning up all the necessary peripherals of a stone computer, like ram skulls on poles topped with mistletoe, banners embroidered with twisted snakes, and so on. Behind the circles of firelight, a large number of plains people had gathered. Druidic festivals were always popular, especially when things went wrong. Rincewind stared at them.
"What's going on?"
"Oh, well," said Two Flower enthusiastically, "apparently there's this ceremony dating back for thousands of years to celebrate the, rebirth of the moon, or possibly the sun. No, I'm pretty certain it's the moon. Apparently it's very solemn and beautiful and invested with a quiet dignity."
Rincewind shivered. He always began to worry when Two Flower started to talk like that. At least he hadn't said picturesque or quaint yet. Rincewind had never found a satisfactory translation for those words, but the nearest he'd been able to come was trouble.
"I wish the luggage was here,"
said the tourist regretfully. "I could use my picture box. It sounds very quaint and picturesque." The crowd stirred expectantly. Apparently, things were about to start. "Look," said Rincewind, urgently. "Druids are priests. You must remember that. Don't do anything to upset them." "But don't offer to buy the stones." "But I..." "Don't start talking about quaint native folk ways." "I thought..." "Really, don't try to sell them insurance. That always upsets them."
"But they're priests,"
wailed Twoflower. Rincewind paused.
"Yes," he said. "That's the whole point, isn't it?"
At the far side of the outer circle, some sort of procession was forming up.
"But priests are good, kind men," said Twoflower. "At home they go around with begging bowls. It's their only possession," he added.
"Ah," said Rincewind, not certain he understood. "This would be for putting the blood in, right?"
"Blood?"
"Yes, from sacrifices." Rincewind thought about the priests he had known at home. He was, of course, anxious not to make an enemy of any god, and had attended any number of temple functions, and on the whole he thought that the most accurate definition of any priest in the Circle Sea region was someone who spent quite a lot of time gory to the armpits. Twoflower looked horrified.
"Oh, no," he said. "Where I come from, priests are holy men who have dedicated themselves to lives of poverty, good works, and the study of the nature of God."
Rincewind considered this novel proposition. "No sacrifices?" he said.
"Absolutely not."
Rincewind gave up. "Well," he said, "they don't sound very holy to me." There was a loud blarting noise from a band of bronze trumpets. Rincewind looked around. A line of druids marched slowly past, their long sickles hung with sprays of mistletoe. Various junior druids and apprentices followed them, playing a variety of percussion instruments that were traditionally supposed to drive away evil spirits, and quite probably succeeded. Torchlight made excitingly dramatic patterns on the stones, which stood ominously against the green-lit sky. Hubwards, the shimmering curtains of the Aurora Coriolis began to wink and glitter among the stars as a million ice crystals danced in the disk's magical field.
"Bellophon explained it all to me," whispered Twoflower. "We're going to see a time-honoured ceremony that celebrates the oneness of man with the universe. That was what he said."
Rincewind looked sourly at the procession. As the druids spread out around a great flat stone that dominated the centre of the circle, he couldn't help noticing the attractive, if rather pale, young lady in their midst. She wore a long white robe, a gold torque around her neck, and an expression of vague apprehension.
"Is she a druidess?" said Twoflower.
"I don't think so," said Rincewind slowly.
The druids began to chant. It was, Rincewind felt, a particularly nasty and rather dull chant, which sounded very much as if it was going to build up to an abrupt crescendo. The sight of the young woman lying down on the big stone didn't do anything to derail his train of thought.
"I want to stay," said Twoflower. "I think ceremonies like this hark back to a primitive simplicity, which..."
"Yes, yes," said Rincewind, "but they're going to sacrifice her, if you must know." Twoflower looked at him in astonishment.
"What? Kill her?"
"Yes."
"Why?"
"Don't ask me. To make the crops grow, or the moon rise, or something. Or maybe they're just keen on killing people. That's religion for you." He became aware of a low humming sound, not so much heard as felt. It seemed to be coming from the stone next to them. Little points of light flickered under its surface, like mica specks. Twoflower was opening and shutting his mouth.
"Can't they just use flowers and berries and things?" he said. "Sort of symbolic?"
"Nope."
"Has anyone ever tried?"
Rincewind sighed. "Look," he said, "no self-respecting high priest is going to go through all the business with the trumpets and the processions and the banners and everything, and then shove his knife into a daffodil and a couple of plums. You've got to face it. All this stuff about golden boughs and the cycles of nature and stuff just boils down to sex and violence, usually at the same time." To his amazement, Twoflower's lip was trembling. Twoflower didn't just look at the world through rose-tinted spectacles, Rincewind knew. He looked at it through a rose-tinted brain, too. and heard it through rose-tinted ears. The chant was rising inexorably to a crescendo. The head druid was testing the edge of his sickle, and all eyes were turned to the finger of stone on the snowy hills beyond the circle, where the moon was due to make a guest appearance. "It's no use you—" but Rincewind was talking to himself. However, the chilly landscape outside the circle was not entirely devoid of life. For one thing, a party of wizards was even now drawing near, alerted by Trumon. But a small and solitary figure was also watching from the cover of a handy fallen stone. One of the disc's greatest legends watched the events in the stone circle with considerable interest. He saw the druid circle and chant, saw the chief druid raise the sickle, heard the voice.
"I say, excuse me, can I have a word?"
Rincewind looked around desperately for a way of escape. There wasn't one. Twoflower was standing by the altar stone with one finger in the air and an attitude of polite determination. Rincewind remembered one day when Twoflower had thought a passing drover was beating his cattle too hard, and the case he had made for decency towards animals had left Rincewind severely trampled and lightly gored. The druids were looking at Twoflower with the kind of expression normally reserved for mad sheep, or the sudden appearance of a rain of frogs. Rincewind couldn't quite hear what Twoflower was saying, but a few phrases like "ethnic folkways" and "nuts and flowers" floated across the hushed circle. Then, fingers like a bunch of cheese straws clamped over the wizard's mouth and an extremely sharp cutting edge pinked his Adam's apple, and a damp voice right by his ear said,
"Not a sound, or you is a dead man."
Rincewind's eyes swiveled in their sockets as if trying to find a way out.
"If you don't want me to say anything, how will you know I understand what you just said?" he hissed.
"Shut up and tell me what the other idiot is doing."
"No, but look, if I've got to shut up, how can I
The knife at his throat became a hot streak of pain, and Rincewind decided to give logic a miss.
"His name's Twoflower. He isn't from these parts."
"Doesn't look like it. Friend of yours?"
"We've got this sort of hate-hate relationship, yes."
Rincewind couldn't see his captor, but by the feel of it he had a body made of coat hangers. He also smelt strongly of peppermints.
"He has got guts, I'll give him that. Do exactly what I say, and it is just possible he won't end up with them wrapped around a stone." "They're not very ecumenical around here, you see."
It was at that moment that the moon, in due obedience to the laws of persuasion, rose. Although, in deference to the laws of computing, it wasn't anywhere near where the stones said it should be. But what was there, peeking through the ragged clouds, was a glaring red star. It hung exactly over the circle's holiest stone, glittering away like the sparkle in the eye socket of death. It was sullen and awful, and Rincewind couldn't help noticing just a little bit bigger than it was last night. A cry of horror went up from the assembled priests. The crowd on the surrounding banks pressed forward. This looked quite promising. Rincewind felt a knife handle slip into his hand, and the squelchy voice behind him said,
"You ever done this sort of thing before?"
"What sort of thing?"
"Rushed into a temple, killed the priests, stolen the gold, and rescued the girl."
"No, not in so many words."
"You do it like this."
2 inches from Rincewind's left ear, a voice broke into a sound like a baboon with its foot trapped in an echo canyon, and a small but wiry shape rushed past him. By the light of the torches, he saw that it was a very old man, the skinny variety that generally gets called spry, with a totally bald head, a beard almost down to his knees, and a pair of matchstick legs on which varicose veins had traced the street map of quite a large city. Despite the snow, he wore nothing more than a studded leather holdall and a pair of boots that could have easily accommodated a second pair of feet. The two druids closest to him exchanged glasses and hefted their sickles. There was a brief blur, and they collapsed into tight balls of agony, making rattling noises. In the excitement that followed, Rincewind sidled along towards the altar stone, holding his knife gingerly so as not to attract any unwelcome comment. In fact, no one was paying a great deal of attention to him. The druids that hadn't fled the circle, generally the younger and more muscular ones, had congregated around the old man in order to discuss the whole subject of sacrilege as it pertained to stone circles. But judging by the cackling and the sounds of Gristle, he was carrying the debate. Twoflower was watching the fight with interest. Rincewind grabbed him by the shoulder.
"Let's go," he said.
"Shouldn't we help?"
"I'm sure we'd only get in the way," said Rincewind hurriedly. "You know what it's like to have people looking over your shoulder when you're busy."
"At least we must rescue the young lady," said Twoflower firmly.
"All right, but get a move on."
Twoflower took the knife and hurried up to the altar stone. After several inept slashes, he managed to cut the ropes that bound the girl, who sat up and burst into tears.
"It's all right," he began.
"It bloody well isn't," she snapped, glaring at him through two red-rimmed eyes. "Why do people always go and spoil things?"
She blew her nose resentfully on the edge of her robe. Twoflower looked up at Rincewind in embarrassment.
I don't think you quite understand," he said. "I mean, we just saved you from an absolutely certain death."
"It's not easy round here," she said. "I mean, keeping yourself."
She blushed and twisted the hem of her robe wretchedly.
"I mean, staying, not letting yourself be, not losing your qualifications."
"Qualifications?" said Twoflower, earning the Rincewind cup for the slowest person on the uptake in the entire multiverse.
The girl's eyes narrowed.
"I could have been up there with the moon goddess by now, drinking mead out of a silver bowl," she said petulantly. 8 years of staying home on Saturday nights right down the drain."
She looked up at Rincewind and scowled. Then he sensed something. Perhaps it was a barely heard footstep behind him, perhaps it was a movement reflected in her eyes, but he ducked. Something whistled through the air where his neck had been and glanced off Twoflower's bald head. Rincewind spun round to see the arch-druid readying his sickle for another swing, and in the absence of any hope of running away, lashed out desperately with a foot. It caught the druid squarely on the kneecap. As the man screamed and dropped his weapon, there was a nasty little fleshy sound, and he fell forward. Behind him, the little man with the long beard pulled his sword from the body, wiped it with a handful of snow, and said,
"My lumbago is giving me jip. You can carry the treasure."
"Treasure?" said Rincewind weakly.
"All the necklaces and stuff. All the gold collars. They've got lots of them. That's priests for you,"
said the old man wetly.
"Nothing but talk, talk, talk. Who's the girl?"
"She won't let us rescue her," said Rincewind.
The girl looked at the old man defiantly through her smudged eyeshadow.
"Bugger that," he said,
and with one movement picked her up, staggered a little, screamed at his arthritis, and fell over. After a moment he said from his prone position,
"Don't just stand there, you daft bitch. Help me up."
Much to Rincewind's amazement, and almost certainly to hers as well, she did so. Rincewind, meanwhile, was trying to rouse Twoflower. There was a graze across his temple which didn't look too deep, but the little man was unconscious, with a faintly worried smile plastered across his face. His breathing was shallow and strange. And he felt light, not simply underweight, but weightless. The wizard might as well have been holding a shadow. Rincewind remembered that it was said that druids used strange and terrible poisons. Of course, it was often said, usually by the same people, that crooks always had close-set eyes, lightning never struck twice in the same place, and if the gods had wanted men to fly, they'd have given them an airline ticket. But something about Twoflower's lightness frightened Rincewind, frightened him horribly. He looked up at the girl. She had the old man slung over one shoulder, and gave Rincewind an apologetic half-smile. From somewhere around the small of her back, a voice said,
"Got everything? Let's get out of here before they come back."
Rincewind tucked Twoflower under one arm and jogged along after them. They seemed the only thing to do. The old man had a large white horse tethered to a withered tree in a snow-filled gully some way from the circles. It was sleek, glossy, and the general effect of a superb battle charger was only very slightly spoiled by the hemorrhoid ring tied to the saddle.
"Okay, put me down. There's a bottle of some liniment stuff in the saddlebag, if you won't mind."
Rincewind propped Twoflower as nicely as possible against the tree, and by moonlight, and he realized by the faint red light of the menacing new star, took the first real look at his rescuer. The man had only one eye. The other was covered by a black patch.
His thin body was a network of scars, and currently twanging white-hot with tendonitis. His teeth had obviously decided to quit long ago.
"Who are you?"
"Bethan," said the girl, rubbing a handful of nasty-smelling green ointment into the old man's back. She wore the air of one who, if asked to consider what sort of events might occur after being rescued from virgin sacrifice by a hero with a white charger, would probably not have mentioned liniment, but who, now liniment was apparently what did happen to you after all, was determined to be good at it.
"I meant him," said Rincewind.
One star-bright eye looked up at him.
"Cohenish, my name, boy."
Bethan's hands stopped moving.
"Cohen?" she said. "Cohen the Barbarian?"
"The very shame."
Hang on, said Rincewind. "Cohen's a great big chap, neck like a bull, got chest muscles like a sack of footballs. I mean, he's the disc's greatest warrior, a legend in his own lifetime. I remember my granddad telling me he saw him. My granddad. He faltered under the gimlet gaze.
"Oh," he said. "Oh, of course. Sorry."
"Yes," said Cohen, and sighed. "That's right, boy. I'm a lifetime in my own legend."
"Gosh," said Rincewind. "How old are you exactly?"
87.
"But you were the greatest," said Bethan. "Bards still sing songs about you."
Cohen shrugged and gave a little yelp of pain.
"I never get any royalties," he said.
He looked moodily at the snow.
"That's the saga of my life. 80 years in the business, and what have I got to show for it? Backache, piles, bad digestion, and 100 different recipes for soup. Soup! I hate soup!"
Bethan's forehead wrinkled.
"Soup?"
"Soup," explained Rincewind.
"Yeah, soup," said Cohen miserably. "It's me teeth, you see. No one takes you seriously when you got no teeth. They say, 'Sit down by the fire, Grandad, and have some soup.'"
Cohen looked sharply at Rincewind.
"That's a nasty cough you have there, boy."
Rincewind looked away, unable to look Bethan in the face. Then his heart sank. Twoflower was still leaning against the tree, peacefully unconscious, and looking as reproachful as was possible in the circumstances. Cohen appeared to remember him too. He got unsteadily to his feet and shuffled over to the tourist. He thumbed both eyes open, examined the greys, felt the pulse.
"He's gone," he said.
"Dead?" said Rincewind. In the debating chamber of his mind, a dozen emotions got to their feet and started shouting. Relief was in full spate when shock cut in on a point of order, and then bewilderment, terror, and loss started a fight which was ended only when shame slunk in from next door to see what all the row was about.
"No," said Cohen thoughtfully, "not exactly. Just gone."
"Gone where?"
"I don't know," said Cohen, "but I think I know someone who might have a map."
Far out on the snowfield, half a dozen pinpoints of red light glowed in the shadows.
"He's not far away,"
said the leading wizard, peering into the small crystal sphere. There was a general mutter from the ranks behind him, which roughly meant that however far away Rincewind was, he couldn't be further than a nice hot bath, a good meal, and a warm bed. Then the wizard, who was tramping along in the rear, stopped and said,
"Listen."
They listened. There were the subtle sounds of winter beginning to close its grip on the land, the creak of rocks, the muted scuffling of small creatures in their tunnels under the blanket of snow. In a distant forest, a wolf howled, felt embarrassed when no one joined in, and stopped. There was the silver sleeting sound of moonlight. There was also the wheezing noise of half a dozen wizards trying to breathe quietly.
"I can't hear a thing,"
one began.
"Shh! All right.
Then they all heard it. A tiny, distant crunching, like something moving very quickly over the snow crust.
"Wolves?" said a wizard.
They all thought about hundreds of lean, hungry bodies leaping through the night.
"No," said the leader. "It's too regular. Perhaps it's a messenger."
It was louder now, a crisp rhythm like someone eating celery very fast.
"I'll send up a flare,"
said the leader. He picked up a handful of snow, rolled it into a ball, threw it up into the air, and ignited it with a stream of octarine fire from his fingertips. There was a brief, fierce blue glare. There was silence. Then another wizard said,
"You daft bugger, I can't see a thing now."
That was the last thing they heard before something fast, hard, and noisy cannoned into them out of the darkness and vanished into the night. When they dug one another out of the snow, all they could find was a tight, pressed trail of little footprints. Hundreds of little footprints, all very close together, and heading across the snow as straight as a searchlight.